I'm Mike Lupica, MSNBC and MLB.com.
I'm Thomas George, NFL columnist and author.
And I'm Mitch Albom of the Detroit Free Press, and welcome to this edition of the Sports Reporters Podcast, the podcast living on of the long-running ESPN TV show from Sunday mornings. We do this podcast now Mondays and Fridays, and we find ourselves in the midst of Super Bowl week, at the very start of it, with a basketball story to kick off before we get into any football stuff or analysis of what's going to be happening next Sunday night. That's because Anthony Davis, the most coveted of potential free agents out there, and a game changer for sure if you go by his five all-star status and his age, has made the official announcement through his agent, Rich Paul, who has some interesting connections to LeBron James, that he will not be coming back to the New Orleans Pelicans, that perennial loser of a franchise. He will not sign a contract extension and is asking for a trade. Mike, how does this shake up the NBA?
Well, first of all, this story, Mitch, I think we will agree, was as inevitable as the tide. That Anthony Davis would someday, he was not saying where he wants to go, and it's not guaranteed that he will go to Los Angeles, even though, you, Mitch, you know my theory, that even dead players want to go and play in L.A. now. But Rich Paul, who, Mitch, hell, it's right on the tip of my tongue. Who does Rich Paul also represent?
Just up here. Hold on, I got some papers.
Wait. I know it. No, I got it. It's LeBron James. Okay.
That's right.
I love the fact that the business is called Clutch Sports, because guess who's got the New Orleans Pelicans by the balls? Rich Paul and Anthony Davis. Okay. But this is the bigger theme here is one that's been going on. It's the cool kids theory of the NBA. We talk all the time about whether we like the big team theory of sports, okay? But this is becoming more and more like AAU basketball. I want to go play with my friends. I want to go play where the cool kids are playing. And at this rate, there's only going to be every year, and Mitch, you talk about this a lot, three or four legitimate contenders to actually hoist the Larry O'Brien trophy. And guess what? Sometimes it's less than three or four.
Yeah. And I have no doubt that it's going to be one of those three or four that Davis will end up with if his agent can engineer the thing. Now, remember that this is still in the hands of New Orleans if they want to actually make the trade, you know, so they don't, just because he wants to play in LA, you know, some other team comes up with a better package and they want to get rid of him before the February trade deadline, they can do it. They still control that. Let's look at the pieces on the board here. New Orleans is a lousy franchise. I'm not sure basketball ever really works down there. They're 26th in the league somewhere when it comes to attendance. They have losing records. I'm not sure, no matter who you put down in that building there, unless you said dead players, you know, it would be Pete Maravich.
Will Chamberlain is coming back.
Would get the interest up in New Orleans. So if you're sitting there in New Orleans, you say, okay, this guy, our best player, he's been a star, he's been an all-star, still hasn't, you know, made the turnstiles ring. Now he doesn't want to be here. How do we want to handle this? Do we want to just go the draft pick route? Do we want to be the Philadelphia 76ers and then just try to build for the future? Or do we want to try to get some name players in exchange for our name player, because we don't want nobody coming in our doors? You have to look at it first from New Orleans' point of view, because they still control him for now. You know, we're so used to players saying they want this, they want that, that they're going to get it, but they can control his where he goes. Now, let's say he ends up somehow becoming a free agent, or they just, you know, blow this somehow. All right. There's L.A. There's Boston. There's L.A. And there's
Boston.
Well,
there's a Clipper. There's two teams. There's two teams in L.A.
Because there's a lot of teams with draft picks that could package things together where he could end up. But he would make, because of the kind of player that he is, he would make that kind of a difference, I think, complimentary to the players on those teams.
Kyrie and Mitch, Irby. Mitch, by the way, the one thing we should have said at the start of this conversation, I meant to mention it before, He's looking now. He'd have to leave money on the table if he leaves New Orleans. Okay. Do you know what the Supermax deal is he's looking at?
I was stunned.
$240 million for 5 years.
Yeah. At one point in that contract, he will make over $50 million a year to play NBA basketball. A guy who's never even sniffed a championship. $50 million that they could offer him. And he's going to walk away from that because if you break it down and he takes sort of shorter contracts instead of taking a longer one and then comes back, they've analyzed it to death here. And he can basically make within a few million dollars of that $250 million deal by going elsewhere. So that's even weirder that he can be a free agent, he can sign smaller deals and still make that kind of money. The NBA has gone off the roof. And, I mean, a single year now for a superstar player constituted what used to be a career, Mike, for guys. You know, earn $50 million over the course of a career. That means you played 15 years and you did all that. $50 million to play a single season, and it's going to happen for him. So he's only 25. He can become an unrestricted free agent in 2020. And, you know, he's got the steering wheel. He and his agent, you know. I mean, and even if they trade him to someplace else, it's only going to be as long as the contract that he has now. So how many teams are going to want to do that if it's not where he wants to go? So as much as, you know, the old-fashioned fan wants to say, come on, be loyal to your team and all that, that's not the way this world is working. And he will be able to steer or dictate pretty much where he's going to want to go just by saying, well, you can trade me there, but, you know, I'm leaving there as soon as Mitch, my contract is up and I'm a free agent.
And Mitch, how long before the following name goes into the same story that we're reading today? And that name is Giannis Antetokounmpo. Mm. Okay? Because how long is it going to take this ascendant star, this amazing talent, to look out the window in Milwaukee in January and then think about the view that LeBron and the other cool kids have in Los Angeles and think, okay, now the difference between Giannis and Davis is Giannis is on a real team now, okay? And it's not out of the realm of possibility that he could have the stage of the NBA Finals this year. But you still wonder how, if he wants to play his whole career or his prime or the next part of his prime in Milwaukee, or if he will eventually want to go play with the cool kids.
Yeah. I mean, it wouldn't be something if you ended up with the whole league in California,
right?
You know, between Golden State and the Lakers, except they're both in the West. So you're going to have to eventually some they're going to be like the whole Harlem Globetrotters. The Washington Generals team from the East will go and play against the Harlem Globetrotters from the West, and it will always be a West championship. I don't think that's healthy for the league. I certainly don't think that that's what Adam Silver wants. I keep waiting, Mike, for your team, the New York Knicks, to somehow enter into all this stuff, because you can only be bad for so long in a major city like that before hitting the bottom and being able to lure somebody. There's somebody has
Wait
to
a minute.
Say...
Hold on. Did you say before hitting bottom? No. Not only do the Knicks hit bottom, Mitch, they hit it again and again. It was just a few years ago when Phil the Thrill Jackson came and was the chief operating savior of the New York Knicks that they were 17-65. Now they're on their way, you know, they're playing out this season in Tankville again. And these young players, they want their money, but they do want to win. They do want to have a chance to be playing in June.
All right,
and
but
Mitch,
but,
I don't know if one guy can do that for the Knicks.
Well, one guy's going to be very smart if they do it. And it could end up, by the way, happening this year, depending on how bad the Knicks are. If they get
Zion in the draft?
Right. Now, can they? Did they trade away?
No, they have their own pick.
They have their own pick.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So if they should somehow get Zion Williamson in the draft out of Duke, then someone who like Anthony Davis, who's 25 and has a big upside, would be very smart to go to a place like New York if that kid's going to be on the team, because you'll then be able to attract a third. And you're right, Mike, they've been awful for really long, but you see how fast, witness Cleveland, witness Miami, how fast teams can go from crap to superstar if they get three stars in their team. And let us welcome in Thomas George, who joins us, longtime NFL columnist and author, and New York area resident, to weigh in on this.
I totally agree with you, Mitch, on that, because it'll take some leadership and vision, but also we heard all this conversation about Kevin Durant when he first went, and it was a ready-made product to Golden State, and there's no real value in that. And but the idea of coming to New York and being a part of the Garden and the Knicks is the polar opposite of that, and being a part of something special, it's a very special opportunity. And I think the leadership and the vision at the Garden, along with the player, the talented player, maybe it's an Anthony Davis, who gets that, has an opportunity to do something really special.
Who's leadership and vision? Thomas, who, certainly not anybody associated with the New York Knicks.
Yeah, that's what I said.
Someone who's not there yet.
Yeah, it's going to take some leadership and vision. We'll have to figure out where that comes
from.
Is
the ownership there, Mike, such an impediment that they won't hire the right leadership, that they'll stand in their
Listen,
own way?
There has been this is like inside baseball. Okay, there's one consistent guy in management pretty much over the last decade and more, and that is Steve Mills, okay, who is now the president of the team. I think that's his title now. And so Scott Perry, who was with the Magic, is the general manager. David Fizdale, that's the management structure, okay? But you look at who are they going to go up against? Danny Ainge? Are they going to go up against the guys in Golden State? Are they going to go up against Pelinka and Magic Johnson? Are they going to go up against Lawrence Frank and even Jerry West and Doc Rivers in Los Angeles? Come on. The Knicks have lost for two decades, as more games than anybody else in the sport, okay? And so the magic of Madison Square Garden, what are people talking about? There's been no magic in the play. James Harden brought magic to the place when he scored 9,000 points the other
but
night.
The idea that this is a mecca
is a myth.
But it is the biggest city in the country, and it is the biggest media capital in the country. That isn't Los Angeles. It's New York. And someone has a massive opportunity there, and an agent is going to convince a player of this somewhere that, yeah, forget about Garden Legacy and all the rest of that crap. It's New York City. And if you can come in and own New York City, right, you can make a lot of money
on
the side.
It's not just one. It's in this league. It's not only do they have to get the one guy that they never get, they got to get two. They got to get at least two.
But that was my point about if they should somehow luck out and get a Zion Williamson, get a number one pick, and sign somebody who's big, a free, a Kawhi Leonard, an Anthony Davis or something like that, suddenly you become the cool kids. It only takes two guys to become the cool kids. Again, look at Miami before LeBron. Look at Cleveland before LeBron when he came back the next time. And look at LeBron now in Los Angeles. I mean, they had nobody in Los Angeles. Los Angeles was just, you know, a better attended Madison Square Garden. They were awful for years, and he goes there, and now they're a winning team. By the way, that raises a question about Anthony Davis. Yes, he's got fantastic stats. Yes, he's been an all-star player. He also gets hurt to the tune of 14-15 games every single year. And if he's that great, how come the Pelicans don't even sniff anything? You know, LeBron James goes to a moribund team and they're in the playoffs, and then they make a run at it. So I don't think Anthony Davis is LeBron James. I think Anthony Davis is the best available big-name player, but does he really turn around a franchise by himself, or is he better if he goes to a place where there's a couple of other superstars?
Well, okay, when he came out of Kentucky, okay, and he won Cal, his one national championship at Kentucky, believe then, and I believe now, that he's a transformational player. I think he is that gifted. And by the way, last year he missed six games. He played 75 games last year. He played 75 games the year before. So
he's
it's not
now
like he's turned into a young Bill Walton or something like that. Yes, he can't do it alone. They made the boneheaded decision that they could go with him and Boogie Cousins for a while in New Orleans, and that didn't work out. Okay, but the new Twin Towers. He needs more than anybody. You know, we were talking about Chris Paul and James Harden the other day, and he needs somebody like Chris Paul, who used to play in New Orleans, by the way. He's like a great, great, great wide receiver, but he still needs a quarterback.
There's some notes, statistics that were out recently that said using all of the modules for efficiency rating that the number one player is Wilt Chamberlain, number two is LeBron, and Anthony Davis ranks number three.
Wow. I don't know what that means, but that's an impressive
way. Yeah. Well, basically, what it's saying is the guy, when he's on the floor, is efficient. The key thing about that, I think, is, and a valid point, is his injury proneness. But I believe, as you were saying, Mitch, there, I believe that if he does understand the possibilities of what he can have here in New York, and they are able to build pieces around him as they go, I believe that Fizdale is one of the better coaches they've had in a long time. And I believe that his impact in the organization can make a difference. So there is an opportunity here, I think, for them to create something new. And I think Anthony Davis would be an excellent part of that.
Well, I think everybody would love to have him, particularly since he's one of the few NBA players that plays defense. And, you know, he blocks shots. He's the defensive player of the year, on that squad annually. And, you know, when you score 28 points and 11 rebounds, and you block a few shots and you throw a few assists, and you're 6'10". You know, it's a valuable piece.
Mitch and Thomas, are you comfortable, and this has been going on for a while, are you comfortable, because we keep talking about Rich Paul, but Rich Paul, it's impossible to know where Rich Paul ends and LeBron begins, okay? Are you comfortable with LeBron being this kind of de facto front office executive with the Los Angeles Lakers, the way he was with Cleveland, and it wasn't that way in Miami because Riley was there. But are you comfortable with that?
I think people across the league understand there comes a point where your stature as a player, and particularly in this NBA, is such where it goes with the territory. LeBron is LeBron, and no matter where he is, he's going to have a say. He's going to be a factor. And I think the sooner you understand that when you bring him on board, the more you understand the entire package of what you have. And so it doesn't really matter whether anybody is uncomfortable with it. It's a fact.
Well, I think it's a deal you make, Mike, with him. If you don't want it, you don't go after LeBron James. What's odd to me is that big personalities like Magic Johnson and Rob Pelinka, who's there now, who I know from his Michigan days, who both feel like, you know, they're pretty smart guys and they can make it happen themselves, were willing to move over and basically move this machinery in order to improve their team. And I don't know how comfortable they are with it. We're not going to hear that. You know, there's stuff that might go on between, hey, I'm the GM here. You know, no, you're not really the GM here. Hey, I'm the coach here. No, you're not really the coach. Because LeBron is coach and GM. And we all understand that when he gets to a team, he brings his machinery in. I don't even know, you know, as you were talking there, Thomas and Mike, I was thinking, he's so aligned with Rich Paul and all those guys, you know, in his group who are all kind of part of the same business. Is it possible for him to own a piece of another player's contract? Like, could he end up owning an agency that represents another player and he makes money off that other player's contract? I don't even know if that's against the rules in the NBA, but if it isn't and it's possible, you know he's the first guy who's going to do it, you know? He would be the first guy who would have his teammates actually giving him percentages of their salary as an agent representative through another guy named Rich Paul. And that's what you get with LeBron. But on the other hand, Mike, look at him. When he's out there, they were in the playoff contention. You know, were as high as like fifth or sixth. As soon as he got injured, they're also Rans. So it's the devil you know. It's the deal you make. He is transformative, all by himself, more than anybody else, including Anthony Davis, is going to be. And if he ends up bringing in Anthony Davis, Kawhi Leonard, somebody like that to play with them, within a couple years of LeBron James' arrival, you're going to see them in the NBA Finals.
I'm going to add very quickly to that, Mitch and Mike, that dynamic with Magic Johnson is something worth watching as they go forward, because Magic Johnson thinks a lot of himself for good reason, and has a tremendous ego and really has a great basketball value in his own right. And so as that continues to move forward, there's going to be some true, not necessarily meetings of the minds, but clashings of the minds that could have a lot of effect.
And here's the other thing about Anthony Davis, and it's worth mentioning this. He's got all the power here. Okay, now they can keep him, but if he's not going to sign a contract extension, they know they're going to lose him, and they're not going to win before he gets there. Rich Paul told this is a tweet from Mark Stein that he has not given the Pelicans a preferred trade destination for Davis. But Davis's free agency, which comes up in basically a year and a half, obviously gives him a huge say in where he lands, since no team will surrender meaningful assets for a player it can't re-sign. All I was thinking about today was Bryce Harper and Manny Machado wish they had as much power to dictate where they're going and get what they want in baseball as basketball stars do.
Well, is there a reason that they didn't while they were still, you know, with their teams?
Because they thought that they
thought that the free agent
market. They misread the market. They misread the fact that baseball is moving away from those contracts. And Thomas, Mitch and I talked about this the other day, that there are so many bad 10-year contracts out there. The baseball is just simply, in a world of analytics where the general managers have this kind of power, they're just not going to give them out. Yes. So I always laughed when I started hearing that Bryce Harper is going to be the first $400 million man. No, he's not. Mm-hmm. No, he's not. And that offer, the $300 million plus or whatever that the Nationals put on the table a while ago, I have a feeling it's going to start looking better and better to him.
Well, and the reason in the NBA that you know you don't have that is because you can basically get a pencil and paper out and figure out exactly what you can make, because it's a salary cap league and these salaries are defined. I mean, what's different about him versus Machado or Harper is that Anthony Davis can tell you right now exactly how much money he's going to earn over the course of the next 5 years if he stays with New Orleans, or how much he can earn with another team and if they give him the max. It's all written out there. It's all a percentage of the salary cap money, and so it's much more defined, whereas baseball, long lauded for the fact that it doesn't have a salary cap and everyone thinks that you can make more money there, actually not necessarily, because you know you have, then now you're at the whim of the owners, and what used to be was the owners always went crazy, couldn't control themselves, and so that's why a no salary cap league was attractive. But the flip side is when they do control themselves, whether you call it collusion or you just call it fiscal responsibility, suddenly you can't demand that money. You can't just say, well, you know, based on our league rules, I have to get this or I'm going to get this. You might be just sitting on your butt. And that's the risk that you take in that sport.
And guess what? Guess what? Jerry Reinsdorf once said famously that all it takes is one dumb owner. It's like my friend Bill Goldman said, everybody talks about bidding wars. All you need for a good bidding war is two people. You don't need eight, you don't need nine, you don't need 10. It's two people who want the same thing. Maybe the era of the one dumb owner in baseball is ending. Because in basketball, you're right. They know what they can make. They know exactly what they're leaving on the table. Davis knows what he's leaving on the table. And over time, Mitch, how many times have we talked about this? It's money that won't affect a single day of the rest of his life,
right. Whether
he stays or goes. Okay, but there's way more cost certainty in the NBA than there is in Major League Baseball. And just for the sake of this conversation, because baseball does play into this, Bryce Harper is thinking, well, wait a minute, I'm young, I'm Anthony Davis, so how come people aren't throwing money at me and opportunities the way they are at Anthony Davis right now?
There is a really very bright, a fine yet blurry line between fiscal responsibility and collusion, is there not?
Yeah.
But I don't think this is collusion in baseball, Thomas. I honestly don't. I think these guys are looking at their spreadsheets and saying, well, wait a minute. Do I want to give $400 million or $350 million to Bryce Harper for 10 years or 8 years or 9 years? Or the Dodgers, should I just go over, get A.J. Pollock, who's a terrific player, on a five-year deal? And they're thinking to themselves, is Bryce Harper going to give me all that much more and help me win all that much more than Bryce Harper or Manny Machado would have?
Well, there'll be time to get to that when they actually sign, and there'll be time to get to Anthony Davis when the trade deadline will be the most interesting thing, which is coming up in February. But I can't imagine that things are going to happen before then. But who knows? The NBA's funny. All right, there's a little football game coming up on Sunday night between the Rams and the Patriots. I believe both now safely ensconced in Atlanta, and coming at it from really different angles here. And there's many, many things to talk about. Of course, on Friday, we'll set up our whole sort of analysis of.
Well,
of
you the game. You'll have looked at the game film.
I've broken down the film by then. I'm still getting film sent in from because I like to compare.
Are you going to look at the Rams first, the Rams defense, or the Patriots?
I like to study the new team. Because I've already studied so much Patriots film over the years, and right now I'm breaking down. Actually, I'm doing the defensive secondary of the Rams.
Oh, okay, good.
As we're speaking,
yes.
I'm doing that.
And you have a long first-hand view of Ndamukong Suh,
I've seen him frequently run off to the sideline saying he's tired in a Detroit Lions
uniform. And Mitch, if you've looked at the defensive secondary, especially with the Rams, you probably determined by now that you thought that was pass interference against the Saints.
Yes, why rehash the past, Mike? Okay. We're on to the future.
Okay.
But what I wanted to bring up here, which I think is a really interesting angle of the Super Bowl, is the coaches. A lot of times they try to build up some kind of rivalry between the two coaches, and it's not that interesting. Bill Belichick versus Sean McVay is really interesting because you really have the guy who has dominated football for the better part of the last 15 years, and the guy who might dominate football for the better part of the next 15 years. And their approaches, their styles are as different as their ages, but both work. And, let's start with Belichick here. Is this, as some people have said, his best work, considering the team that he's worked with, considering they blew that Miami game, considering they had to go on the road, considering they lost Josh Gordon, considering their first round draft pick never played because he got injured, all those things, and a 40-year-old quarterback turning 41. Is this the best work that Belichick has done to get a team to a Super Bowl?
I think you have to give Belichick a lot of credit for being able to manage a football team east and west and north and south. I mean, it is just incredible how when other teams are faced with certain situations, how they handle them and how he handles and is able to keep his team, the core of it, on the same page, striving toward the same thing, one goal in mind, and building as the season goes on, getting better. But the one thing also that is closely associated with Belichick's success that cannot, I think, be pointed out enough is the fact that Tom Brady is who he is. No matter how great a coach Belichick is overall, the Tom Brady factor, along with his coaching, I think is a 50-50 proposition here, and in some instances leans more toward the 60-40. And so Belichick, in part, is what he is and has accomplished some of the things he's accomplished because of the quarterback.
Well, yeah, Thomas, you're 100% right. I mean, this was the debate with Bill Walsh and Joe Montana. How much of it was Joe, and how much of it was Bill Walsh, okay? Who, whatever everybody else ever did with X's and O's, the one who first started moving him around in this kind of creative way was Bill Walsh, okay? And he saw something in Joe Montana, who it wasn't like he came out of college as Peyton Manning. And, we've done it to death, the sixth-round draft choice story with Tom Brady, okay? But clearly, every piece you see and every piece you read, once Brady was in the house, Belichick saw something in this young man. And so, Mitch, when you ask me if this is the best job he ever did, I actually think the best job he ever did was the first time they played the Rams in a Super Bowl. When they weren't supposed to win, and they did win. And yes, this partnership is unlike anything we have ever seen in pro football or will ever see. The coach-quarterback thing in New England. But you keep going back to this fact. Belichick will turn 67 this year. Sean McVay just turned 33. He was an offensive coordinator when he was 28 years old.
Yeah. And twice his age.
You're right. He might be a savant on training wheels right now, the way Belichick once was.
I want to point out something about Belichick. I'm going to say kind of two opposing things here, because I do think what he does in the postseason is remarkable, and the way that he plots for teams is unparalleled. I'm looking at the Patriots' season this year. And they came out and they won their first game barely over the Texans. And then you remember they lost to the Jaguars, who sucked by the time the year ended. They lost to the Lions, who sucked by the time the year ended. Now, you're looking at a, you know, wow, we just lost two crappy games here. We could be going into a tailspin. Who do they get next? The Dolphins. And they clobber the Dolphins, and they go on a 6-game winning streak. All right? Then they lose to the Titans again. They come right back from the Titans, and who do they get? The Jets. So they beat the Jets, and they start winning again. Then they lose those two games towards the end of the year. We all know, you know, they lost to the Dolphins on that ridiculous play. And then they lost to the Steelers. So they're in trouble in December. And they come back, and who do they get? The Bills and the Jets to finish out the season, and they clobber them. My point is, whenever the Patriots start to get a little dizzy or reeling, they get to turn around and play the other people in the AFC East.
There you go.
And they have benefited so greatly from having no rivals in that division year after year after year. Just by comparison, I sit here in Detroit, and okay, Detroit's a terrible franchise with a terrible history with bad management and all the rest. But there is that thing that every year they try to turn around and play Green Bay or Chicago or now Minnesota, all these teams that were always, you know, just were well run and were perennial. They were in the hunt and they're good and they go on and win Super Bowls. Nobody comes out of the AFC East and goes to the Super Bowls. Barely does anyone come out of the AFC East besides the Patriots and make the playoffs. So they always get to kind of rebound against a Jets team or a Bills team or whatever, and they don't go into a slide. So I say that Bill Belichick has had that benefit for the better part of the last decade. However, now I go to the other side. He plots and plans for teams better than any coach I have ever seen. And when you watch what he did on the road in Kansas City, where they're perennial, they're not a good road team, the Patriots, when it comes to the playoffs, and he had the perfect game plan there, knew exactly what they wanted to do, take Tyreek Hill away from Patrick Mahomes, control the ball, make sure that you've got a time of possession, make them play from behind. Yeah, he still needed a coin flip to end up winning, but he got the coin flip. And when they got the coin flip, they marched right down and they got the touchdown, which is something that the New Orleans Rams didn't do. I mean, the New Orleans
Saints
did not do against the Rams. So when everyone says, oh, they just got, they just won the coin flip. Well, you know, tell that to New Orleans who had the coin flip. So I'm of a mixed mind with him. I think he's like a guy who gets an automatic 50-point boost on his SATs, but is also a genius.
I agree with that 100%. And not only is that your point, and I also agree with it, but so are many, many other coaches in this league and many other general managers in this league and even ownership, saying a big part of the Patriots' success relies on the fact that the AFC East has just been a doormat for them, you know, just an elixir for them. I mean, it's the fountain of youth. I mean, it's everything that you need, particularly in a rough time, to be able to rebound and get yourself together against these dog teams in the AFC East. And it's really interesting. You wonder, will the day ever come when these teams get and understand and get, you know, upset about it enough and smart about it enough to do something about it? Well, a lot of it depends on the quarterbacks again in that division, and we'll see where Sam Darnold and the rest take it.
Thomas. The Jets had him and lost him. He was the head coach for one day.
Yeah.
He was the HC of the NYJ. Yeah. But I got to read you guys something because Peter King took one of his rides the other day with Sean McVay to work before dawn's early light. And he was talking to him about the one time he faced Belichick as the offensive coordinator with the Redskins. Obviously, that's right. Not the Rams team he has now. 27-10 for the Patriots, 2015 in Foxborough. Just hang with me on this. Oh, yeah, this is McVay talking. That wasn't good. And our touchdown that day was a cheap touchdown last minute in a two-minute drive when the game was over. Coach Belichick and defensive coordinator Matt Patricia took us to the woodshed. Very humbling day. And then he said, he's talking about Belichick, okay? but it gives you an appreciation for just the experience factor of the Patriots, okay? My first year as offensive coordinator, Jay's first year as head coach in Washington, 2014, we practiced against the Patriots in training camp. I remember watching their operation, the efficiency, not a single minute wasted, and it goes on from there. So they did intersect one time. Obviously, he's got some team with him this time, but this young man knows exactly what he's going up against in Atlanta next Sunday.
I've spent some time around Sean McVay in a variety of different circumstances, and I will honestly say that he's one of the really rare people that I've ever met in this league who have that infectious ability to be able to communicate to players, to media. Watch his press conference. He's saying, well, Sam, that was really a good, oh, yes, Jessica. I mean, he knows everybody on a first name basis, not just his players, but the media as well. I mean, the guy really gets the art of communication.
Thomas, just like Coach Belichick. That
yeah, absolutely.
That life of the party.
His approach.
Welcome in.
Yeah, his approach. Now you put that together with the genius, and then what you find there is he definitely it is a different way, but it has been a very effective way because he's connecting with his players in every way, and then he has the tools mentally as it relates to offense in terms of cutting edge. He is, you know, wildcat, spread them out, jet sweep. All of these things that are part of the newer edge offense in the NFL, he is at the forefront of. That's why a lot of his assistants are being hired as head coaches and coordinators as we speak.
And isn't it funny with the guys who are at the top and make it to the Super Bowl? Bill Belichick is a defensive background guy, but he's going to be forever known as having the greatest quarterback.
Yep.
And
he
most,
changed with the sport, Mitch. Yep. He did. And, he changed. He adapted.
The most reliable two-minute offense at an end of a game that any team has ever had. Of course, that is the quarterback, but, you know, you have to have other tools. And here's Sean McVay, who's a total offensive mind, an offensive coordinator, barely out of his baptismal waters doing that. And the Rams are a pretty good defensive team. And they got a guy named Aaron Donald, who's arguably the best defensive player in the league. So you have to, you can't just bring your own specialty to being a head coach. You've got to be able to somehow do it. And what you brought up, Thomas, is interesting to me because in LA, I believe they are playing as well as they are because of the coach, the personality of that coach. In New England, they are playing as well as they are because of the culture, which is cultivated by the coach, but he doesn't have to be the nice guy. In fact, everyone who's ever played for Belichick says he isn't. You never see guys leave the Patriots and go, man, I'm going to miss Bill Belichick. We used to hang around and talk about the old days and he's such a nice guy. They miss the system because as you pointed out, everything, not a minute wasted, everything's efficient and it works. And he can just say, hey, this is the Patriot way. This is what we do here. We emphasize character. We emphasize hard work. We emphasize efficiency. And then you go home. You know, we're not here to have a coffee clutch. And Sean McVay is the opposite. Sean McVay's like, hey, guys, he's younger than some of his players.
Right.
So how can he not be? So that's going to be interesting to see which of those two kind of gets the team better ready for a game like this. I still worry that the Rams could come out and lay an egg. In terms of just being overwhelmed by, you know, I do not worry about that with the Patriots. They're just too seasoned. They may lose, but they're not going to lay an egg. They're not going to like suddenly be dropping the ball and miscommunications and lose track of things. If they lose, they're going to lose because the Rams outplayed them. But the Rams have a very young quarterback, and you know, there's pressure on the coach too for the first time going to a Super Bowl, as bright as he is and as good as he is. And we'll see if that youthful enthusiasm ends up winning it for you. As you know, we saw Nick Foles and the Eagles sort of pull that off last year against the Patriots. Or if the Patriot way, which is steered by Belichick, ends up coming out on top.
It's interesting that the first time these two teams played at the beginning, the real beginning of Brady and Belichick, Brady was the kid at quarterback. Kurt Warner was playing for the Rams. All that stuff. Okay. Now the narrative has been flipped all this time later. Jared Goff is the kid quarterback. Okay. Not only a kid quarterback with a kid coach. But, Mitch, as we've had this conversation today, all I keep thinking is the Wonder Boys come and go, and who's going to be coaching the AFC team in the Super Bowl next Sunday in the Mercedes-Benz Dome, and that is Bill Belichick. And whether the great thing about this is, we're actually debating whether this was his best coaching job. And you know what I think? I just think it was like all of them. I think it was like all of them, and here they are again.
Yeah, I totally agree with both your comments, Mitch and Mike, on this. I think one thing that really stands out to me about this game and about the history of this matchup is the first time they met in the Super Bowl, it was a question of where is the league going? Is it going the Mike March way with innovative offense and pass-happy offense, or is it going to go the Bill Belichick way where, again, defense is front and center and wins championships? And the winner of that game at that time was going to be sort of a signal of the next head coaching hires. And of course, Belichick won it, and there were quite a few defensive coaches selected. Now you've got this, again, offensive-minded, young, innovative coach in Sean McVay, and again, Belichick, the mainstay with his concepts of defense and his defensive background. And again, the matchup is very similar, even though the principles on the Rams side is a little bit different. I think, again, like you were saying, Mitch, the question really is, will the moment be too big for the Rams, the players, and the coach? I don't think it will be, but I wouldn't be shocked if that did happen, because the Patriots have a way of putting so much pressure on you and then exerting their will and using their experience to make you play their game, not your game.
And also to make you feel like you're up against a team that doesn't look exactly like they did on the tape. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think Belichick is really good at. There are a lot of good coaches in this league, and they get their teams to play well, and then all of a sudden they go out there and they play a team and they lose. And you end up hearing, well, it wasn't a good matchup for us. You know, that we're not good against the run, and that team's really good against the run, and you know, we lost on that. Belichick is the best coach I've ever seen at adjusting his team to beat whoever is in front of them. Mm-hmm. And he will come out with a different-looking defense. And Tony Romo, for all of his, you know, over-enthusiasm that people have criticized him for, I appreciated his historical knowledge when he was calling that game, saying, that play hasn't been used in 10 years, probably, and they just pulled it out and used it here against the Chiefs. It's that sort of institutional knowledge and historical knowledge that Belichick brings, and he breaks down the team, that not regular season, but in the playoffs, and especially when he has 2 weeks in a Super Bowl, to say, okay, this is what this team does, so we need to be this team. He doesn't say, we are who we are, we'll put our best guys out there, and we're going to trust that we're going to win. Mm-hmm. He comes out with a different-looking defense, with different schemes. He says, I'm going to take away this and this, and that's how you beat these guys. And 9 times out of 10, he's right. And so I'm interested to see what he's going to come out to the Rams and what he's going to identify with the Rams and say, we are definitely taking this away. If you had asked me 4 weeks ago, I would have said Todd Gurley, because clearly that machine was running with Todd Gurley as its engine. Todd Gurley's been a little funky in the last few weeks, all right? First he was hurt, then he came back, he seemed to be okay, and then in the championship game he was absent. And we still don't have a real explanation for that, except that he said, I played sorry, I was really sorry. So does that mean that Belichick says, you know what, we're going to focus on Goff, and we think that he's not full. We're going to focus on C.J. Anderson, or we're going to focus on Cooks, who used to play for the Patriots, and they're going to have a good game plan for him. But something, they will have a plan that is different for this game and this team, and then he'll throw it out, never use it again, and start all over again when he finds himself in another playoff game. That's what makes him so unique.
And you know what? Here's the thing. Here's the thing about this game. And Thomas, then you weigh in, and then we'll go to party shots. Okay, here's the thing about this game. And we will never see anything like this, I don't believe, in a major sporting event like the Super Bowl. One coach is twice as old as the opposing head coach, and the quarterback of one team is 17 years older than the quarterback of the other team. We have a 41-year-old quarterback trying to win his sixth Super Bowl. We have his 66-year-old coach trying to win his sixth Super Bowl, and we have Sean McVay at 33 and Jared Goff at 24 trying to win their first.
One of the reasons why I think the Rams guys can fans can feel excited about their chances is everything, Mitch, that you described about Bill Belichick and you as well, Mike, Sean McVay possesses some of those traits. I wouldn't be surprised if he has a different offensive game plan for each quarter. I think he understands and gets the part of flexibility and innovativeness that is required to beat the Patriots and to match up against Belichick. And then the other thing that they have going for him, that he has going for him, is he does not blink. He's a very aggressive coach, and he will, I think, be willing to take chances to win this game, which is what you have to do to beat the Patriots in this kind of moment.
I like that idea of a different offensive thing for every quarter. That would be interesting to watch. All right, time for our parting shots. Mike Lupica, please lead off.
There's a story posted this morning on ESPN.com about how an estimated $6 billion will be bet on next Sunday's Super Bowl game. $6 billion. Which, if you're keeping score at home, means just slightly more than the $5.7 billion that you know who wants for the Trump Tower of a Wall that he wants on the southern border. $6 billion on a football game. You can see now why the NFL finally decided to tear down that wall around Las Vegas. If you can't lick them, join them. But then the league and Vegas have had a wink and nod agreement with Vegas for years, unless you think that those injury reports during the season are just made public because the league doesn't want the families of the injured players to be worried about them. $6 billion as people decide who they think is going to win one football game and whether they think the betting line is out of line or not. $6 billion, by the way, that might come down, just keep this in mind, might come down to a flip of the coin to start in overtime or a bunch of flags staying in a bunch of pockets the way they did in New Orleans last Sunday.
Thomas George.
I'm really looking forward to watching one player in particular in this Super Bowl because I think this player has a chance to truly be the MVP. And the MVP in many people's eyes entering could be or should be Brady or Goff, which could be Gurley or Edelman, or it could be Donald or Flowers. But I'm saying that everybody should take a long, close look and keep your eyes on Robert Woods in this game. Rams receiver Robert Woods began his career or played a lot of his career in Buffalo, and he was sort of lost in the shuffle. And I remember talking to a GM about him saying, this guy really has a lot of skills that fit in a high up-tempo offense who could be a great player. And the general manager, who had a lot of respect for it, goes, yeah, he's a serviceable guy. And that's how a lot of people looked at Robert Woods, as a serviceable guy. Until he got to the Rams, until he got with Sean McVay, and until he got into that offense and blossomed into the player he has become. I think it was Troy Aikman who said recently in one of their telecasts, he is the best receiver in football. And Troy Aikman has seen a few of those throughout his career and broadcasting career. Myself, I've watched Robert Woods really develop into something special, and I expect him to be special on Super Bowl Sunday.
I checked the internet Thursday night and saw an ESPN headline. Tiger Woods shoots 70 at Torrey Pines. Since it was the only golf headline, I thought, wow, Woods is leading his first tournament of the year. Only after I dug into the details did I find out that Jon Rahm shot a 62, along with a zillion other players who shot in the 60s, and didn't qualify for headline status. Welcome back to Bizarro Tiger World, where a corner of the media will continue to act like Woods is the greatest golfer in the world until, damn it, he finally plays like it. Never mind the 11 years since his last major or his one win period over the last 5 years. It's WTGR, all Tiger, all the time. Yesterday, the CBS team was almost giddy when Tiger achieved his newly stated dream, getting to double digits below par, which he did on the last hole. Wow! Didn't matter that he was in 20th place. He achieved his goal. Go, Tiger! I know this is tilting against windmills. Doesn't matter what I or anyone else says. Tiger Woods' hype is a machine unto itself. It sells clothing, watches, golf equipment, and yes, newspaper and internet clicks. But it isn't news in the traditional sense. It's insisting that someone who isn't winning matters above golfers who are. And it's an insult to the players who work hard enough to outscore Tiger, but never out-news him. And it won't stop, I imagine, until he does. By the way, the Masters is only 2 months away. Get ready for Tiger time.
Hey, Mitch, by the way, you are 100% right about this. And as you were doing this, I looked at the ESPN Golf homepage. Guess who is the headliner there? Tiger Woods. Guess what the headline is? Why Torrey Pines was just a step in Tiger's bigger plan.
I rest my case. That's going to wrap things up for today's edition of the Sports Reporters. We do this podcast every Monday and Friday, which means we'll be back in a few days to set up the Super Bowl, amongst other things. If you are listening to us for the first time, feel free to leave a comment. Also, tell your friends that they can get this podcast wherever they get popular podcasts, including radio.com. Until we see you on Friday, on behalf of Thomas George and Mike Lupica, this is Mitch Albom saying, have a great week.